This is the Infotagent podcast Inside Europe series, looking at the role of social media disinformation and foreign interference in the politics of different European countries. So far in this series, we've looked at Germany and Poland, and today we go slightly further north to look at the Scandinavian region. I'm joined from Copenhagen by Jonas Perello-Plesner, who's the executive director of the Alliance of Democracies, also a former diplomat, and interestingly, in the 2016 US presidential election, was an OSCE observer of that campaign. Particularly interesting, I think, given the concerns and interest in foreign interference in elections and the role social media plays in elections, really seems to have, certainly around the world, come out of that particular presidential election and what we subsequently discovered about it. I mean, tell us, before we start talking about Scandinavia, Jonas, how was that experience for you in 2016?
Well, thank you, Damon. First of all, thank you for bringing on the podcast, and I look forward to this. I mean, as you say, let's start with the US. I might also, in general, broaden out a little bit from Scandinavia, since our with the Transatlantic Commission on Election Integrity, we have a sort of much broader remit on foreign interference and disinformation. But back to 2016. Yes, I was out as an OSCE observer in Virginia, in Loudoun County, and we sort of went around with a couple of colleagues from precinct to precinct, looked at polling. Quite fascinating also with everything that's happened with Dominion and sort of the tabulation. Let me just say that everything I saw was a system that worked pretty well and was also democratic and energetic, that people piled up early in the morning and had to go to work immediately afterwards, but still wanted to take part in the vote. The experience I had was out in a very small precinct at the sort of border with West Virginia and Virginia, where we went out a little bit actually also for the fun of it. It was very sort of remote outside. So this is the positive part of it. You have, as you often have, the Republican and then sort of Democrat sitting on each side at a table. There were not many voters, so they were just sitting there waiting. The Democratic representative was knitting. The Republican had a MAGA hat on, which was, of course, sort of the standard equipment at that time, but was also reading, it has to be said, on his was reading the Federalist Papers and Rousseau's The Social Contract. But he comes up to me and says, there's election fraud here, and you should note it down. I said, that's important. I will happily do that. That's sort of my job as an international election observer, that people are voting. So that's even worse. I will, if you give me the names and everything, I will go in and check with the election roosters. Well, he said, it's not here as such. You just have to Google it. It's like, if you Google Virginia election fraud dead people, then you will find it. And I said, yes, but this is not kind of how it works, because I have to, as an observer, have a concrete proof, and it has to be in this precinct or some nearby precinct where I can then go to and check it out. And he thought, I think, that we ended up parting on friendly terms, but I think he thought I was like a very bad election observer, that I had not taken it serious, and thought his Google proof was like very much proof of. And I think it's a good example of what, and he was otherwise seemed a sensible guy, what has sort of marred American politics quite a lot, that these things just circulate and you keep having these ideas that in certain parts that people are certain that dead people vote, that there's massive irregularities, and there's been looked into it, and it's just not the case, but you still have a hard time convincing people about it. And that was really, that wasn't even the 2016 elections. There the question was much more the story of the Russian meddling. This became the 2020 election, where you basically had that sort of general, and you still have a large part of the population that thinks that Trump was defrauded the election. So I think that was what you could really see the beginning of at that time. And then I, at that time, just sort of discounted it as an odd little experience. But for me, it became a much sort of bigger litmus test of everything that was going to mar American politics for years to come.
I think it's a really interesting example. And as you say, it sounds like more like something of disinformation from the 2020 election than 2016. I think with the 2016 US election, we were thinking about, you know, was it true that the Pope had endorsed Donald Trump? You know, was the Pizzagate story true or not? But what we see now is something which is more akin to just making people question the whole system, in the same way that disinformation around COVID and the COVID vaccine doesn't always seek to sort of support a different theory, but just to leave you in a position where you're not really certain who to believe and what to believe. And that certainly seems to be a challenge in, you know, across Europe now as well. And we were discussing in the show, looking at Germany again, in this series, again, looking at that question of doubts around the whether the voting system is sound or not, and whether there'll be election fraud. But before we start talking about sort of elections and politics in general, I thought we'd start off by looking at the issue of immigration, which has become a highly polarizing issue in many European countries. And I think social media has played a role in creating a forum for those divisions to be expressed and demonstrated. And I think the debate in Denmark about this is slightly similar to the debate we've had in the UK, and even indeed some of the policy solutions suggested by the UK government, the idea of processing asylum claims away from the mainland of the country, are ideas that have been discussed in Denmark as well. I mean, how have you seen this issue develop in your country over the last few years?
Well, it's been an issue for more than the last few years. It's basically been a sort of defining issue of Danish politics for the last two decades, really. And it might actually, this is just my own prediction, it might fall a little bit in importance, because what has now happened is we have a social democratic government that has come in and is precisely as tough on immigration policy as all the previous right-wing governments. Meaning that you basically, there isn't really any space. I mean, there's a little bit of parties on the left that want it, but they're support parties for the current social democratic government. So they have to sort of live with that there is a top line on immigration, which could tilt to that like suddenly it doesn't become the defining, and maybe income politics, welfare and so on become higher topics sort of again. But at least for the last, that's been the case. And as you say, yes, I think we've seen in Denmark, you mentioned the processing abroad, the idea of making an agreement. It's not really come into fruition yet with Rwanda about processing asylum seekers there on behalf of Denmark in some sort of way. So definitely you have a lot of sort of and pushing it to the limit, what you can do inside sort of the current conventions has also been, I would say, a hallmark of all. And there's been a big difference in Scandinavia, where otherwise normally we always look at sort of Nordic countries, Scandinavia is very similar and all about sort of welfare state and hygge and coziness, where Sweden has had a completely different take and has seen the Danish debate, basically, if we put it bluntly, as sort of racist and xenophobic, and the Danish have seen the Swedes as being completely naive about how immigration is also going to change sort of their society. But if I link it to, so that we move slightly over into our disinformation, I think one of the biggest cases of disinformation we've had in Denmark was actually related to sort of migration, and that was back in 2019 when there was something called it was a UN agreement on migration. It was basically a non-binding, very UN-like declaration that was going to be signed in Marrakesh in December 2019. Suddenly, a couple of nobody had talked about that in Denmark, and it wasn't a big issue in Parliament or really anywhere. And suddenly, that blew up through social media, that this was going to lead to a similar wave of immigration like the 2015 migration crisis, which led to a big influx in Denmark, among other European countries as well. And that we were kind of signing away our sovereignty and allowing in several hundred thousand migrants through that. And that sort of was pushed on social media and became really highly explosive. It potentially also had a bit of foreign interference. It was never really, but there were some nodes in those Facebook groups that were foreign and really brought in a lot of followers to sort of like and support that. And it ended up having, I would say, sort of real life consequences that the then Inger Støjberg, then a migration minister, who initially said like what was the sort of sensible speaking point, this is has nothing to do with our migration policy. We can still set that nationally. This does not sign off any sovereignty to UN or lead to any sort of migration wave. She ended up not going and not wanting to sign it because of that huge sort of pressure on it. And then the prime minister ended up going and saying we're not basically going to be pressured by, you know, a sort of falsified campaign online about what this is to do it. But he ended up then being the one actually going to Marrakesh, signing it, because the relevant minister didn't want to. So I think that's really an example where you have something, you know, that's already highly explosive in a country, a little bit similar to the US, where it's also been topics that's already been explosive, like the Russians went into the sort of Black Lives Matter debate. So here you basically see it's just about fueling something that's already happening on social media. So that was for me, I would say, one of the sort of most, around Danish elections, we haven't had to the same degree and example. So actually, this would be one of the sort of more poignant examples of disinformation potentially also amplified from abroad.
I think it's interesting that the experience of the and the nature of the debate is so different in Sweden and Denmark. I mean, I think for people that travel in Scandinavia, you'd look at cities like Stockholm and Copenhagen, which are not that far apart, and seem very similar. And indeed, you know, certainly in the UK, people refer to the kind of Scandinavia almost as a block of, you know, of countries that are very similar in their politics and outlook in the world. You know, why do you think there is that big difference of opinion between your Denmark and its neighbour?
That's a good question. I think Sweden, maybe a little bit stronger sort of UN, having been neutral about sort of seeing then also refugee immigration policy as something of its humanitarian sort of tradition in a maybe stronger sense than in Denmark. And then you just had political parties that didn't want to touch the subject, and saying this will, if we go down that, it will lead us down a rabbit hole of leading, of course, to potentially, in worst case, sort of racism and so on. But that has also, here I probably also put on my very Danish glasses on it, I would say that's also led to that Sweden now has in some cities really a sense of insecurity in Malmö and other cities where there have been shootings and so on, and now have a right-wing party with the Sweden Democrats that's completely booming. And I would say had the classical parties maybe been willing to take that debate earlier on, you might have been able to avoid that. I think in Denmark, we see with some pride that we had at the sort of start of the century, a sort of somewhat, Danish People's Party far right and really single issue focused on immigration. They've then been brought into parliamentary workings, been support party for several governments, and now they have issues and all, and it basically become a normal party that still has a strong focus on the question of migration, and which I as a democratic process see as positive, that you also don't sort of basically completely shun a certain part of the electorate, but also give some voice, but at the same time make them become part of sort of parliamentary politics.
Yeah, indeed. And even fans of the TV series Borgum will see immigration played a part in that series a few years ago when that program was being made. But I think, what role do you think social media is playing in driving support for more nationalistic parties, more populist parties like the Sweden Democrats that you mentioned? It was interesting to discuss in the show we recorded looking at Germany that even though Alternative for Deutschland is a relatively small party in terms of the opinion polls, about 10%, I should note we're recording this ahead of the German election, so it may be broadcast after we know the results, but AfD have a relatively modest poll share, but have by far the biggest share of voice on social media platforms like Facebook. Do you see something similar in Scandinavian countries?
I don't know the precise numbers, but definitely you see that, like, to the right of the Danish People's Party, there's emerges sort of smaller party called the I don't even know their English translation, but there is a party there, and they've been really efficient on social media. And I think you see the same in Sweden with the Sweden's Democrat. So that a lot of these start out basically as social media courses and then sort of transform into a party. Actually, Norway, that just had its election, had a similar on their whole very heated debate on whether to leave oil or not. And I think 200,000 people signed up to a Facebook group on that. And when they calculated that into national politics, that would make it like the fifth largest party. And that was over a weekend that that happened up to their elections. So you see these cases where, I mean, I would also see it positively, that it also means it gives voice to people as well. So it's I mean, it's also positive. But of course, there are the negative aspect that we're looking out for. What about when then there are like foreign actors that go into those networks, help amplifying or use bots to make it look much bigger than it is? But it's of course not negative bottom up in a democratic society that you could sort of see people that quickly coalesce around an issue. But there are the difficulties in building social media about sort of amplification issue and of course also the foreign interference piece of it.
Yeah, I mean, Russia is always, you know, the name that comes up when we start talking about foreign interference. And I think, you know, in Europe, I think we've certainly seen a Russian narrative, which is about creating division between the EU member states to make the EU a weaker organization. Immigration, I think, is an issue that they have literally, if you look what's happening in Belarus at the moment, you'd say they're literally weaponizing on the Polish border by pushing migrants into the EU that way. Also also challenging climate change as a theory as well. Obviously, Russia has a huge interest in the world being a heavy consumer of fossil fuels. Do you see, you know, what evidence or have you seen or suspicion do you have of Russian interference in Scandinavian politics?
On the social media part, with the Norwegian elections, they were just, we have to wait and see. I have some actually Danish colleagues that have been tasked to work on that with Norwegians, but they will come out with a report in December on it. But where you have clearly seen it is on the hacking aspect. For example, the Norwegian parliament was hacked in August of last year, and much quicker than the German Bundestag, which took years to come out with their assessment. They've actually concluded already by December last year that this was the Russian hacker group's Fancy Bear, or also called APT28, I think it is. And so there you definitely see, so it's with many different levers. You can, of course, go through the social media of amplifying some of the debates in society as a way of foreign interference. But there's also simply then hacking and trying to get documents that you could leak into the debate and everything. It seems like, at least so far, let's wait for the investigation into the Norwegian elections, that they haven't either gotten into that many politicians' email boxes, or if they have, not found something that's so exciting that they made it an explosive content in the election. But we've seen that in earlier cases. I mean, in the US, we used to talk always of like the October surprise, what would come out, which was like in 2016, Hillary's leaked emails. And in 2020, it was supposed to be this laptop from Hunter Biden that contained all the explosive evidence. And there in each case, we've sort of seen a Russian hand in that. But I think you also need a society where people are sufficiently divided that such a sort of thing, you know, even if it can be quickly debunked, it will still have its effect. And that's where Scandinavian countries are probably, I would put, if you look at all the ratings, because of our high level of trust in society, meaning that people's default position will not be, this is the government or that ruling party that's trying to fool us, and I'm sure this is true. I think it's in increasing also in Scandinavia. We've also seen it on the pandemic with an increasing number of sort of anti-vaxxers, but still in relative terms compared to other countries, Denmark is at 80% now of vaccinations. It's still a minority of the population. But definitely social media gives a completely new platform to them as well.
Yes. Yeah, so now, you raised two interesting areas I wanted to ask you about. Firstly, in terms of COVID and disinformation around COVID, what role you think that's played in the last 18 months? I think it's been very interesting because I think it's shown the power of disinformation within a non-party political context. You know, something new has come along. We're not entirely certain how coronavirus started, though we think we know. We've developed vaccines that we know are effective in treating it, but people won't take them because they've been told that they may not work or they could have negative health impacts. And there was a threat, I think, before the vaccines were launched and people started being vaccinated, there seemed to be a growing rise across Europe in vaccine hesitancy, people saying they wouldn't take it even when it was available. And the experience of COVID within Scandinavia has been different too. I mean, the approach taken by the Swedish government was very different to that of its neighbours. I mean, what role do you think conspiracy theories and disinformation around COVID have played in Scandinavia?
Like in many other countries, a relatively big role, also because on social media this travels. So if there's some, you know, study that shows globally that masks do not work, then it immediately, you know, or some study that might be true or fake, then it immediately travels. So in that sense, you have all these things entering the national debate that you didn't have in the same way sort of before. And I would say I'm also, when I sometimes look at Facebook and the communication of our health authority, which I think has been good, but then when I see some of the replies below about like comparing them to almost like Nazi doctors and so on, you're like, wait, but who writes this? And these are these real people? So you've seen that as well. Again, it's still, if you look at the numbers, it's still a minority because 80% is vaccinated in Denmark, and I think the other Scandinavian countries have similarly high numbers, but definitely you see that. And then there's that difficult trade-off also in the tech companies and the social media companies, because at some point they were at the beginning, I think, because they know how much they've been seen as botching the 2016 and 20 elections in the US, they were like, we're not, this one here is important. But I also think as someone who believes a lot in freedom of expression inside democracies, that it's also been, if they then start basically throwing people off the platform or like removing that, then you create these martyrs that assure their freedom of expression. So there is also a question, what's the right response to this from the tech companies? What I prefer is labeling and refer to other sources. That must be the way to sort of kind of, because at the moment you throw people off, or they write even more like, Facebook doesn't want me to tell you the truth, and now I'm over on YouTube where you can see it and everything, and then it even creates bigger sort of conspiracies around that. So I think it's also important to say you need a certain amount of debate. This was also, you know, uncertain times. Nobody had the answers. And when we said in the beginning, you know, trust science, yeah, but I mean, on some of the points, science was also divided. Like our health authorities, for example, were never great proponents of masks, which some other countries are like, we had them, and but now we actually don't have them anymore and have just phased them out, which some countries would, I think health authorities would disagree with and say, no, that's like precaution, it makes sense to keep them. Ours didn't. So of course, science also differs slightly. So I think there should be that space also for discussion, so that we don't share it. But it's a really tricky balance.
It's no, it is absolutely. And I think actually in the past, when I've spoken to people in Sweden and Denmark in particular, I think there seems to be, I think in your region, there is, I think it's always struck me a very sort of, I don't know if libertarian is the right word, but sort of libertarian view towards the internet. I mean, it was in Sweden that the Pirate Party first really manifested itself, of people believing you should be able to download music without paying for it. And actually they had, a fair degree of political representation. It spread a little bit as an idea, but not greatly. I mean, do you think that is the case? Because I think, in other countries in Europe, I think particularly in the UK, there's been a very strong sense that, you know, anti-vaccine, the big anti-vaccine movements spreading disinformation about the vaccine shouldn't have the right to have their message amplified on social media.
No, probably true. I mean, the sort of the freedom of expression point of view, I also just gave, I think is probably, you have Denmark, you also remember, I mean, I was a serving diplomat then with the Katrine crisis, and the way Anders Fogh Rasmussen, our then prime minister and now my current chairman and founder here of the Alliance, he held firm, in some view too firm, on just saying there's no way a government will issue anything that looks like an apology on these cartoons, it's the freedom of the press, and we'll kind of defend that, and people can reprint it, and there you could see quite different traditions. I mean, especially actually the UK, I think at that time was also passing some early hate speech legislation or something like that through Parliament, and was very, very lukewarm in kind of the support of what we saw clearly as a fundamental attack on our democratic kind of values over freedom of expression. So I think definitely you're right. There is a little bit of that that transition, and that's maybe also what I exemplify when I say I don't really want them all kind of taken off, because then they'll just create of Facebook and Instagram martyrs, and they move to Reddit anyway, and spread the same. So I would rather want the kind of the open debate, and the tech companies can of course help by several ways, by not amplifying as much if it's something that's proven false, and by labeling. But I do think removing and pulling people off platforms is really sort of last resort, because then you create that kind of wrongly sort of martyrs of freedom of expression that feels that their voice is being removed.
And you said earlier on that trust in public institutions is pretty high in countries like Denmark compared to elsewhere in Europe. And I just wanted to ask what the role of traditional media plays there, because there definitely seems to be a trade-off that in countries in Europe where trust in media or traditional media is still seen as an important source of news, that disinformation is weaker in those countries. And in countries where that trust in the mainstream media has been eroded, then disinformation seems to spread more effectively. I mean, do you think that is the case? Do you think Danes and others in Scandinavia still have a high level of trust for their traditional media?
I do. I think that's clear. And I think, for example, in the US, the fact that local media completely disappeared, apart from the few national papers, I think does make for poorer, probably in a lot of the states, democratic debate there. There's nobody, and they only have social media, which is both national and global to cover it. It doesn't mean that it's not also difficult for Danish newspapers, and a lot of them has had it's a business that, if you see it as a business, that's not going too well, particularly also the local papers. We have a quite public system, so they get some level of public support as well. I think that keep it afloat. But for politicians, this is maybe something we could talk about as well. I mean, I've now jumped out of the shadows many years of being an advisor to politician and diplomat and everything, and is now running for local office here in Denmark as a conservative for our municipal elections in 16th of November in Gentofte, which is a sort of a suburb borough to Copenhagen. And here I'm sitting in doubt about applying this in practice myself. Like, how much do I put of ad money into Facebook and Instagram? We actually don't have an account yet. Or do I put it into the local paper? Well, knowing that there is a target group that I will not get at all with the local paper, because I cannot get my own teenage sons to ever read in a paper and not at all the local paper. So that those are real, I would say, dilemmas also as a politician. And meanwhile, if you do it, it of course means that the money in a local democratic election basically goes to some of the tech companies for running not just our public debate, but also running sort of the ad money around it. So in practice, and you're a much more experienced politician, Damien, than me, those I think are difficult choices to make, where in theory I would like to put it all into the local paper and say this is what I want to support. They still have, whereas Facebook doesn't really, it's not their business of making our local community run well or have a good public debate. So in that sense, but in practical terms, as I'm getting told by so many advisors, if I don't do any advertising on it, I have a much lesser chance of ever getting elected.
I think that's right, and I think the central role of social media as an advertising tool and a tool for discourse for politics is growing, and I don't think it's it's a question that, well, you know, young people use it, and then when they get older, they then transition to more traditional media. I think that's not happening. It's people stay with it, and therefore the average age goes up and up and up over time of for people that, you know, primarily access news and information through social media. I mean, it's been suggested that one of the reasons that in Scandinavia people have been effective at trying to define and isolate disinformation campaigns is that news in the local language is sort of easier to track. There's sort of the volume of news in Danish will be less than the volume of news in English globally, and therefore it's easier to track and spot. But do you think for people in countries like Denmark, do people sort of mix sort of local news content in Danish with international content in English, and would rely on both equally for their news?
Well, I think the local aspect it plays in definitely that you have it in your own language. But I mean, it probably also plays in negatively that we see in a lot of cases with smaller languages that the tools that Facebook, Instagram, Twitter and others have developed after the bad experiences in the 2016 and 20 elections, they apply much less effectively to other languages. Mm. That they're basically used to tracking terms in English across the board, which so they're actually with the Transatlantic Commission on Election Integrity, we rolled out these election pledges, and we've done it in the US, in Canada, in Georgia, the country, and in now we're doing it in Germany. And with Georgia, one of the findings we had was definitely that a lot of, because it also has its completely own alphabet, that a lot of the tools that were developed by the tech companies really didn't work because of on there, and that basically if you could enter the debate, then you could say that was also hard for the Russians, so they often used Russian language when it was easier to see that these were also Russian influence operations. But there you definitely had that there was such a small language group, so basically for Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and others, developing tools specifically for that language and that election was probably seen as too costly, and they would say we'd rather focus on some of the big languages. So I think that's definitely a two-edged sword, where you both have that local, smaller languages are a bit more insular and protected, but you also have that when there is something going in there, then you don't necessarily have just access to the same sort of tools that you can use in English. That was actually the example I gave earlier in the 2019 example with immigration, where there were these couple of really with big followers, but they had not posted on Denmark kind of a lot before, or maybe posted on English-speaking news. They suddenly entered and were like, bringing all their followers onto this question that this migration pact would may lead to a new sort of wave of mass migration into Denmark, where you can, it was never proven, as I said, but where you can think, okay, where this actually orchestrated from abroad, seeing there's something here we can target onto into the Danish debate. And there, of course, it looks odd with somebody, which is why I got noted, saying why there are people that are based in Spain that keep tweeting on sort of the Danish migration debate. But with the application effect, you can still do it. It doesn't matter whether you think the people actually are the bots really understood, whether if it looks massive enough and as a politician, you have to react to it. If just thousands and thousands are keep tweeting this every time.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think we see now as well the increasing role of I think social media influencers in driving campaigns of disinformation. I was looking at the recently published report of the Election Integrity Partnership in America, looking at the 2020 election, and that seemed to be one of the key learnings, that it was influencers with big followings that were key to getting these campaigns going. But Jonas, it's been really fascinating talking to you for the podcast. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Damon. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to the Infotainment podcast focused on Scandinavia, hosted by me, Damien Collins, and featuring Jonas Perello Plesner. You can find out more about Infotainment at our website, infotainment.com, and also support this show by becoming a Patreon at patreon.com/infotainment podcast. Thank you. Until next time.